In 1896, a professor from Cambridge University in England was allowed into a storeroom in the back of an old synagogue in Cairo, and he found a whole series of old Jewish manuscripts piled up in that storeroom. Now, in the Jewish tradition, they have reverence for their scriptures particularly and for religious writings in general. And so they would not intentionally destroy an old manuscript. So what happens when manuscripts get worn and are difficult to use anymore is that they are quietly put into a storing space in the back of a synagogue. And they are allowed then to quietly turn into dust again, just as all life does. And so these manuscripts had been sitting in this little room, gradually decaying as time went on, for many, many years. Nobody really knows how long they had been there. And when these manuscripts were then sort of taken to Cambridge and people started to read them and interpret them, they found one that was really very interesting. It was there were, of course, a number of copies of the old books of the Bible, but in addition to that, there were a number of other secular writings. And among them was one which was quite interesting in its scope, for it dealt with life in general in the first half. It was what we might nowadays call an exhortation. It was a statement that we should be aware of our heritage, speaking from a Jewish point of view, from the people in the synagogue, and we should treasure this heritage, and we should make an effort to preserve it and sustain it. And that's the sort of beginning third of the manuscript. And then you come to the second section of the manuscript, which was a very detailed analysis of the laws of Moses. And many of these things were expanded and transformed so that they fitted into life in a different context than the context in which Moses had originally written those documents. So it was a rather strange manuscript, and they had never seen anything like this before. And when they started to translate it, they found a couple of phrases which were really very interesting. And I'll reading here from a translation. They shall distinguish between clean and unclean, and shall proclaim the difference between holy and profane. This, you see, is part of the beginning, the introduction to the sequence of laws which then follow. They shall keep the Sabbath according to its exact interpretation, and the feasts and the day of fasting according to the finding of the members of the new covenant in the land of Damascus. And this then gave the manuscript the title of the Damascus document, because it referred to people being under a new covenant relationship in the land of Damascus. And then it said, they shall set aside the holy things according to the exact teaching concerning them. They shall love one another, each man his brother as himself. They shall succor the poor, the needy, and the stranger. You see, it's a very altruistic definition of a society that was based in Jewish law. And people began to wonder then, what was this Damascus thing all about? Because there was no real historical reference to a Jewish community. Oh, there were Jews in Damascus, Jews in Syria. There still are Jews in Syria. But there was no real historical reference to a community which had gone and established a brand new covenant relationship with God in Damascus. So what did it mean? Well, if you go back a couple of paragraphs in this writing, you find these words. But God remembered the covenant with the forefathers, and raised from Aaron men of discernment, and from Israel men of wisdom, caused them to hear, and they dug a well. The well which the princes dug, which the nobles of the people delved with the stave. And then comes the interesting phrase. The well is the law. And those who dug it were the converts of Israel who went out of the land of Judah to sojourn in the land of Damascus. So you see, it probably wasn't Damascus at all. The well wasn't a real well. Of course, they did dig wells there. And, of course, that was part of the reference to what people did when they established a new community. But the point was that the well, in their language, was a figure of speech. It was a reference to the values upon which they built their lives. It was a reference to the fact that their lives were dependent on the laws which Moses had given for God's people to establish their society according to these regulations. Now, in later years, when the rabbis started to catalogue all these laws, they came up with the number 613. 613 different regulations in the law of Moses. And each one of them covers some facet of life, for Jewish life. And then if you look at the second phase of what was referred to as the Damascus document, you find many, many more regulations than the 613. For they had been expanded and reorganized slightly and redirected to meet the way of life that people were fitting into as time went on. But what time was that? What was the reference point? And what has this got to do with the Dead Sea Scrolls? Well, it's certainly got a little bit to do with the Bible, hasn't it? Because we're, of course, talking about the law of Moses. What's it got to do with the Dead Sea Scrolls? Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls were first discovered in 1947, and in the succeeding years, then, a number of caves along the shores of the Dead Sea were excavated by Israeli archaeologists who tried to get ahead of the Bedouin, who was taking these scrolls because they realized that they could sell them for real money to people that valued these ancient Jewish manuscripts. And so there was a whole series of manuscripts which came to light. And close to a community along the shores of the Dead Sea, which we know as Qumran, there were two major scroll caves found. And one of them had as many as 700 different manuscripts in it. That was Cave 4. Cave 1 had a lesser number, and then there were three other caves quite close to this area, which seemed to have been sort of places where a few people would go to shelter at night, and there were a few scrolls found in those caves. Now, the archaeologists, when they got into this whole routine, and of course nowadays with high elevation photography and so on, you can do wonders to expose the way people lived in these lands. And you can find the walking trails that people took to go from the place where they lived in the buildings around Qumran, out, for instance, to the toilet on the one occasion, off to Cave 4 on the other occasion, which seems to have been the main library for that community, out to Cave 1, because that was a secondary repository of scrolls. And in spite of the fact that some people have been very critical of the early archaeology, it's now almost certain that many of those scrolls were written at Qumran by the people who moved there. So who were they? And why have we got this Damascus document? What is there about that? Well, Jewish and Roman and Greek history, there's reference to a community along the shores of the Dead Sea, and they're considered to be the Essenes. And if you look in Josephus and look at the history of the Jewish people around the time of Jesus, you discover that there were a community of Essenes along the Dead Sea, but also that there were Essenes living in the greater community, people that belonged to Jewish society in total. However, Josephus makes it quite clear that that group had removed themselves from the temple. Josephus makes it quite clear that even the Essenes that lived in the greater community of Israel had nothing to do with the temple itself. Oh, they took sacrifices there, but they would not set foot in the temple. Why wouldn't they do that? Because they considered that the current priesthood had profaned the temple. That temple had been profaned from at least the year 163 in their thinking of the people that moved to Qumran. In 163, the Maccabees threw out the Seleucids and re-established a Jewish state. But the Maccabees didn't re-establish the Jewish priesthood. they decided that they would be priests in their place. They were the senior people. They were the military rulers. They were the people who ran Israel. Why shouldn't they also handle things in the temple? And there was a considerable dispute among Jewish, all sorts of Jewish factions at that time. And it seems that the group that established themselves in Qumran disagreed so severely with what happened from that point on, and there were several other incidents, similar incidents, which took place, which were not in line with the priesthood the way it had been set up under Moses, and things were not done according to the way Moses had instituted them in the first place. And so this group that established themselves in Qumran, it appears, were very close to the priesthood in Jerusalem, but who disagreed so severely with what was happening that they took themselves off into the desert. And they saw themselves, in the words of Isaiah the prophet, as the voice of one crying in the wilderness. They were there to prepare the way of the Lord. They had removed themselves from secular Jewish state. They had removed themselves from the religious Jewish state. And they removed themselves to what they expressed figuratively as the land of Damascus. And they set themselves up with a new covenant in the land of Damascus. It wasn't Damascus at all. It was down by the Red Sea. But it was figuratively outside Jewish soil. And it was a new covenant, because they couldn't sacrifice. They couldn't prepare the things that they were supposed to prepare. It said they should keep the feasts exactly. They should keep the law exactly. They couldn't keep the law exactly, because they couldn't sacrifice anything in the temple. They weren't allowed. They wouldn't allow themselves to go into the temple. How did they get around that? Because of what they called this new covenant. And they hark back to the words in Jeremiah, where a new covenant would be established in their hearts. And they should establish their relationship with God, not through physical sacrifice, but through the sacrifice of themselves. In the study that they did, in their moments of prayer, in the fellowship they had one for another, in the way they looked after one another, the care, that's just what we read there from this book, which was the Damascus document, which was found, a 10th and a 12th century copy of the document found in Cairo. When was it written? And what about the scrolls in general? Well, firstly, let's talk about the scrolls as a group. There are some 900 different manuscripts, depending exactly how many caves you include in your listing, a little less than 900 that were almost certainly part of the Qumran community's library, a little more than 900 if you go as far away from Qumran as Masada, and some other caves where manuscripts have been found along the shores of the Dead Sea. About 900. Over 200 of them were books that we recognize from the Old Testament. And if you haven't looked already, in the showcase we have a copy of the Isaiah scroll, which was found from Cave 4 in Qumran. And that's about two-thirds of the actual size. It's been reduced in size by about a third. It's a photographic reproduction of that Isaiah scroll. That's typical of the scrolls which were found at Qumran, these old Jewish writings. 200 of them were books of the Old Testament, 700 of them, in round figures, 700 of them were non-biblical texts. Texts of all variety of things, including texts like this Damascus document, which I read a little bit from. If you look at the age of the scrolls, there are some scrolls that could be as old as 300 BC. There's a copy of Samuel, a copy of Exodus, a copy of Jeremiah, which are certainly in and around the 250 to 300 BC dating. There are many other biblical scrolls which were written somewhere around 150 to 200 BC. Now, the archaeologists make it quite clear to us that the Qumran community was established somewhere around 150 BC. And it was occupied until the Romans destroyed that settlement in 66 BC when the Roman army swept up the shores of the Dead Sea, 66-67 BC. 80, I'm sorry. So it's somewhat around 200, possibly a little more than 200, is the maximum period of occupation for this Qumran community, the period when these scrolls were accumulated. Some of the scrolls they obviously took there. That copy of Samuel was written before the scroll community was established. They took that there. Several of the biblical texts were included in these very old scrolls. There are also a number of scrolls which were sort of religious literature. There's a book, there's Tobit, for instance, and Enoch, which is certainly dates to at least 200 BC. The scrolls were that old. So they were obviously taken to Qumran when that community divorced themselves from the temple, went to the shores of the Dead Sea, and built their little settlement there. If you look at the Damascus document, the earliest possible writing for one of those documents is about 150 BC. And the historians who analyze the content and look for clues to what people maybe have been experiencing around them when they wrote the manuscripts down also agree that 200 BC is the very earliest that the ideas in this document could have been developed. So you see, what we're looking at are a series of scrolls which were taken there, which were largely religious writings, when this group divorced themselves from Jerusalem, and a further series of scrolls which were developed in Qumran. And many of the scrolls which were developed there define in very precise terms the way people should live. Now remember, they couldn't sacrifice, but they still kept the Sabbath. They had no way of keeping the sacrificial aspects of their festivals, of their annual festivals, and yet they still kept them rigorously. That was there in that phrase which we read to you. They had to keep those festivals at the right time. So even though only part of what was included was part of their ritual, they nonetheless organized their lives according to the things which they had understood and kept in mind when they left Jerusalem. I want to read two other little segments to you because it illustrates very, very clearly and very graphically how rigorously and how seriously they took their observance of Moses. Now, we're going to spend most of the time looking at the Sabbath, the way it occurs in the New Testament, and sort of pick up ideas there as they are reflected in the scrolls. Because when we look at what is written in the New Testament particularly, many of the ideas and the phraseology which we have in the New Testament come right out of this period of history. In other words, the New Testament was Jewish literature from the early part of the first century. The Dead Sea Scrolls are Jewish literature from the same period. The things they talk about, the words they use, are identical in many cases. Now, but what about the way this group who went to Qumran considered their lives? What about the way they treated the Sabbath particularly? No man shall take anything from his place on the Sabbath, from outside the house into it, or from the house outside, for him to interpret and read in the book on the Sabbath. Now, isn't that interesting? I brought my Bible here tonight. It wouldn't occur to me that I couldn't take a book outside to read on a holy day. But to them, this idea of doing no work on the Sabbath meant exactly that. You didn't even pick a manuscript up to carry it outside. You sat down in your house and you read it there. Now look at this other little point. Got to put my glasses on to find the right page. (Clears throat) No man shall revise the scroll of a book reading its script on the day of the Sabbath. But they may read it and study it. No man shall make plans with his mouth on the day of the Sabbath. He shall not talk about any matter relating to work or wealth on the day of the Sabbath. He shall speak no word apart from speaking holy words as prescribed and from pronouncing blessings of God. He may, however, and the however is my insertion, he may talk about eating and drinking. Isn't it interesting to have a group of people who saw their new covenant being bound so tightly by things which were written in the time of Moses and such a rigid interpretation of that which was written in Moses? If they were reading a book, they weren't even allowed to go get a pen, pick it up, and correct the text if they found a mistake. I don't know whether you've looked at the scroll which we have in the showcase. That's a copy of the Isaiah scroll, and please look, please have a look at it before you go. And we can unroll it further and see some more aspects of it. There are interesting spots in it where people have made obvious corrections. And this was part of scribal tradition, that you sort of grew up as an apprentice. You started out making the parchments, and you started out doing the manual things, the lining, ruling the lines on the parchments and things of that nature, long before you actually got to write on the scrolls. You learnt your trade from the bottom up. But then once you had been an established practitioner, when you had been writing scrolls for some years, and you really knew the text, you checked the work of the junior scribes, and when you found mistakes, you corrected them. So, before we go now to look at the reading which we did from Matthew, and some of the things which flow out of those ideas which I presented to you, have a quick summary of the Old Testament scrolls which are there. Every book of the Bible is represented among the scrolls in Qumran. Every book of the Old Testament, and that is, except for Esther. And Esther, of course, refers to the Feast of Purim, which was the feast of the dedication of the temple. And the, this goes back to the time when the community of the Dead Sea removed themselves from the temple itself, so they would have nothing to do with that feast. And then again, the I've lost my train of thought for a second. It doesn't happen to me very often, but it does. And the other text which is not present is Ezra and Nehemiah. It was thought that there were fragments of Nehemiah present, but it is now almost certain that what was considered to be a fragment of Nehemiah is not. So there are three books of the Old Testament which are not represented. But almost all of the others are represented in multiple copies. And not only that, the copies which are there, the most common copy is Deuteronomy. No, Psalms is the most common, then Deuteronomy. And then, I'm losing my voice in them. The Psalms and Deuteronomy and Isaiah, which is the scroll in the bookcase. And very interestingly, these are the three books of the Bible which are quoted the most frequently in the New Testament. And so you see there's a parallel between the scrolls that people were accumulating and the scrolls that people were quoting from when you get to the New Testament. And that in itself is interesting. And then the books of Moses are very prevalent, and other major prophets, and several copies. Minor prophets are a single scroll, and they are there in a number of copies. Historical books are all present. As we said, every book except for Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah is present in at least one copy, and most of them in more than one copy. Some of these books go back to about 300 BC when they were written. Others were written in the 200 to 100 BC period and may very well have been taken to Qumran. But then there's a whole series of books which were quite clearly written by the people who made that settlement in Qumran, who we think of as the Dead Sea community. They valued their scriptures, they copied them, and they reproduced them very carefully. And a word about the text then, because there are at least three traditions for the text of the Old Testament. There's the Masoretic text, which we're accustomed to in our King James Version and most of our modern English translations. There's the Samaritan text, and there's the and there's the Greek text, which was translated by the 70, the Septuagint, as it's called, in Alexandria. It was translated into Greek from Hebrew manuscripts because the Jewish people were spreading throughout the Middle East when the Greek Empire was established throughout the Middle East. The Jews settled in that whole area, and they, of course, they've always had this trait for business, and they followed the money where it was. They became very successful men, and so they were working in Greek. And the Greek Bible, the Septuagint, was there, and it is slightly different from the text which we have in our English Bible. All three of those texts are present in Qumran. But the interesting thing, when you really look at the changes in the manuscripts which were made by people that were working on them, you know, crossing out and little bits that are added in, places where people have found bits which were missed and another scribe has copied it back in, places where people have made even spelling mistakes, and some of them allowed to remain. If you think about what is actually done with the text in all of these places, the concern almost exclusively is to the preservation of meaning. And we should be acutely aware of that, because in our day and age, our English language is changing in front of our noses. Words which meant one thing when I was a boy mean quite different things now. And when you look back on your life, you realize that language is a fluid thing. And it's important that whatever you've got in a written document, and we have a plethora of English translations nowadays which are attempting to address that point, and we certainly don't understand 16th century English expressions very well anymore. And so it is important to keep the language up to date. And that seems to be many of the scholars that have studied these scrolls in detail. That seems to be what was happening with the scribes and the traditions that we have before us in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So as far as the Old Testament is concerned, the books are there, the text is there, and the text is reliable, and we can say that on the basis of the findings of the Dead Sea Scrolls. What about the New Testament? Well, what about the chapter which we read from Matthew? There are two events in that chapter. One of them is where the apostles were picking ears of corn when they walked through a field. And, you know, I don't know whether you've done this. I know when I was a boy in England, there was fields with wheat around us all the time. And so you could pick one of these things off and you rub it in your hand, and then you can pick out the stalk and throw that away, and then you blow it carefully, because there's husks on the ears of wheat. You rub it again, blow them away again, and after a couple of such times, you've got a fresh series of kernels from that ear, which you can eat. And that's what the disciples were doing as they walked through their field. The next thing that happened was that Jesus cured somebody. And the interesting thing is that there's an interjection in that story. That story of Jesus curing somebody is repeated in Mark and in Luke. But when it's repeated, the thing that Jesus interjects into the story is not there. Jesus says, what happens if an animal falls into a pit? What are you going to do? And that happens on the Sabbath. What are you going to do? Now, why put that into the story? It doesn't add, it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting contrast. It makes you think about what's going on, but it's not necessary to the story which is there. It's not a necessary part of the story. Let's look at it. Let's look at Matthew 12. Jesus, on the Sabbath day, went through the corn. His disciples were hungry, began to pluck the ears of corn and eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they say, "Behold, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath day." Why would they say that? Well, this one we can trace quite clearly back to Moses. Because the food which you ate on the Sabbath day had to be prepared ahead of time. The food which you were going to eat on your day of rest had to be got ready, and everything that went with it had to be got ready. If you needed to warm something up, the fire and all the wood and everything had to be there, so that you didn't go out and do something, you didn't work to complete your meal. You could warm it up, you could do simple things like that, but it had to be ready to eat. So technically, what the disciples were doing as they rubbed the ears of corn, as they walked along and picked as they were going, technically they were working. And the Pharisees, the people who were watching Jesus, recognized that they were indeed walking and moving their hands and blowing and doing all these other things. They were preparing their meal. It was contrary to the rigidity of interpretation of the Sabbath as it was laid out in Moses. But that's not the one which really piques our interest. The one that really piques our interest is when you get a little further down. Now Jesus answered that one and said, "Well, look what the priests do on the Sabbath. They do a lot of things to prepare what they have to do on the Sabbath, and they're considered blameless." That's in verse 5. "But I say unto you, that in one place, that in this place is one greater than the temple. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And when he was departed, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man with a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days?' That they might accuse him." They expected him to do things like that. He had done a number of miracles, and many of them were healing miracles. But now they were saying, "Is he going to continue this behavior on the Sabbath in our synagogue?" And another place which we'll look at a little later, the ruler of the synagogue says, "Well, there were 6 days when you could have done this. Why wouldn't you do it then? Why profane the Sabbath by healing someone on the Sabbath?" There are two responses to this, and the first one comes out of later rabbinic writings. That about 200 and onward, in rabbinic writings, it was made quite clear that if it was a life-threatening situation, then it was perfectly realistic to intervene. But if it was non-life-threatening, then we said a little earlier, there are 6 days for you to do that. Do it in the six, and don't do it on the Sabbath. So that was what the rabbis developed in their thinking over the next couple of hundred years. But what was the thinking at the time when Jesus was speaking? You see, that was a developmentalite thing. That was where the rabbis went. When the Jewish people were removed from their temple, their whole way of life had to change. And the Sadducees, with their regular temple worship and their schedule of worship in the temple, were the group that disappeared. It was the Pharisees who developed Jewish rabbinical thought and developed the thought which we have in the synagogues to this day. That the law of Moses has based on principles. Those principles should be adaptable. And whatever circumstance you find yourself in as the years go by, the principles in Moses should be applicable. And that's where the rabbis went in their thinking. Jesus throws into this mix then this rather interesting little point. "And he said unto them, 'What man shall there be among you that shall have a sheep? And if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep?'" Now that was Jesus' position. What was the position of the people who were questioning him? Or if it wasn't their position, What was the position of a number of people who were alive at the time of Jesus? Now, as we said, there's a parallel in Mark 2 and in Mark 3 and in Luke 6. And let me read you another little section from the Damascus document. No man shall assist a beast to give birth on the Sabbath day. And if it should fall into a cistern or a pit, he shall not lift it out on the Sabbath day. No man shall spend the Sabbath in a place near to the Gentiles, and on it goes. No man shall profane the Sabbath for the sake of riches or gain on the Sabbath day. But if any man should fall into water or fire, let him not be pulled out with the aid of a ladder or a rope. Now that's interesting, isn't it? If one of your friends should get into trouble, you couldn't get a ladder or a rope to help him, but you could. You could, and that's in another place, you could take your coat off and offer it to him and pull him up with the aid of your coat. And we'll read that section in a moment. You see, Jesus put an idea into the system which we have here. It was a question was realistic. Should you cure somebody on the Sabbath? Was that work? And Jesus said to them, what are you defining as work? And he used this very example which we have here of an animal getting into trouble. They said you couldn't do it. It was work. You must not do it. And that was certainly one of the views which was prevalent in Jewish society at the time when Jesus was speaking. But you could, later on in rabbinic writings, you could offer something to support them. You could take pillows and things and so that they could sit on it. And you could do things of that nature to help the animal out, but you couldn't lift it out on the Sabbath. They were a fatalistic group. And if you read between the lines in many of the other sayings which are there among these secular writings of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's quite obvious that what they felt was that it was God's will that that animal had fallen into this unfortunate situation. And if it was God's will that the animal live, then it would still be there on Monday morning when we could go and get it out. And if it was not God's will that the animal lived, well, we should not interfere with God's will by pulling the animal out on the day of rest, on the Sabbath day. A parallel instance is in Luke 13 and Luke 14. Let's look at Luke 14 first. Luke 14, 1-6. If it come to pass, Jesus went into the house of one of the Pharisees. Behold, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. And Jesus spake to them and said, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? And they didn't answer. And he said, which one of you shall have an ox or an ass fall into a pit and will not straightway pull him out? And on that occasion, they couldn't answer it. And let's look at another little section here. The one that I mentioned a minute ago. No man shall lift an animal which has fallen into water on the Sabbath day. But if a man falls into water on the Sabbath day, he shall pass to him his garment to lift him out. But he shall not carry an instrument to lift him out on the Sabbath day. And then, and on it goes. You see, there was a distinction made among those thinking of those people between animals and human beings, but the regulations were very rigid, and they were not permitted to do what was considered work, even under what we might consider very difficult and very horrendous situations for people. Similar thing is there in Luke 13, just pointed out to you, chapter 11, verse 11. Woman which had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years bowed down. Jesus saw her. He called to her and said, woman, you're loosed from your infirmity. He laid his hands on her and she straightened up. And the ruler of the synagogue became indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day. And he said there are 6 days, and we referred to this earlier, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them, therefore, come and be healed, and not on the Sabbath. You see, the imagery and these little things that Jesus throws into the story, the points that he challenges them with, came right out of contemporary Jewish thought. I got into this topic because there's a lot of discussion about when the New Testament was written. A lot of textual critics feel that most of the New Testament couldn't have been written any earlier than about the year 200 AD. And yet when you look at examples like this, the things that Jesus talks about came out of writings which were current in Jerusalem when Jesus was there. They had been written 50 years earlier, in many cases, were still being worked on when Jesus was there, and some of the manuscripts are being changed, and we can see subtle changes in the way the laws of Moses were being interpreted as that time period went on. These things were still being talked about. They were still current in people's minds. They were contemporary ideas. There's one or two interesting examples in John. Let's look at chapter 9, verse 16. Time's getting on. Jesus went in to the Sabbath. It was Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened the minds and eyes of a blind man. And the Pharisees said, "This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day." But others said, "How can a man that is a sinner do such miracles?" And there was a division among them. And that's what we see, isn't it? Between the Pharisees, and if we were to go into it in any detail, between the Pharisees and the writings which are there among the Dead Sea community, between the Pharisees and Jesus, there was a lot of difference of opinion in Israel at that time. And much of it surrounded the keeping of the Sabbath, and much of the examples which they discussed were also discussed by the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are three other things that I want to draw to your attention before we sit down. And the first one is the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are people, for they shall receive something. It's a way of teaching. It's a way of explaining things. And among the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is what are called the Beatitudes manuscript, because it's written in that same style. Blessed are people who do this, and they will also do that, is the way the Dead Sea Scrolls manuscript is written. And that was written about 100 BC. You see, that teaching method which Jesus employed in what we think of as the Sermon on the Mount was used by the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was contemporary thinking. Another thing which is current, in the Old Testament it is very difficult to see very much of argument for the idea of resurrection. And yet when we step into the New Testament, it's everywhere. And yet when we read the secular Dead Sea Scrolls, you can find a document which is called the Resurrection Document. And that document says that Messiah will come, will do a whole series of miraculous things, and in addition to that, he will raise those who are dead. And that was what Jesus did. He demonstrated his power with the miracles that he did, and one of the greatest miracles was to raise people from the dead. It's there in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then I'd like to look very quickly at Matthew 22, just for a few minutes, to look at the structure here in Matthew 22. The Sadducees, which said there's no resurrection, came to Jesus and said, there's a man and seven brethren, and the first man married a wife, and he died. And then in the law of Moses, to preserve the bloodline, the woman was to marry the next brother. And she married every one of the seven brothers. Interestingly, that story probably came from the book of Tobit. And was the book of Tobit around at that time? It certainly was. We have copies in the Dead Sea Scrolls of this book, which were written in and around the year 200 and were copied up until the first part of the first century AD. And it's an interesting story. Tobit was an interesting character. He was considered to be full of good works, and that was one of the instances, which it's a story very similar, of someone who had seven partners and lived through all seven, and a different conclusion is drawn, but nonetheless the story is there. It's contemporary Jewish literature, and contemporary Jewish literature was used as an argument against Jesus, and Jesus turned it round against them and said, you don't understand anything because you don't know about the point of resurrection. And then comes a lawyer to him, one of the Pharisees. And they heard that the Sadducees had been put to silence. One that was a lawyer, and he was a specialist in all these 613 different regulations that there were in the law of Moses. And he was one of the people that, although he may not have agreed with everything which was there in that book, in that document, which is referred to as the Damascus document, all of the different ways of looking at the regulations in Moses, he certainly knew the subject. And he said to him, which is the great commandment? Jesus answered that and then said to him, now I have a question for you. What about Christ? What about the anointed? What about God's anointed? Whose son is he? And the lawyer said, why, David's son, of course. The Messiah must have come from the line of David. The first time we meet these ideas in Jewish writings are among the Dead Sea Scrolls. We read of a prophet which should come. And that again picks up on the thought of John the Baptist preceding Jesus and the way that was used between them and the New Testament. And then the Messiah of Aaron and of Israel, the priestly figure and the secular figure. It's here in the Dead Sea Scrolls writings, not in the biblical writings, but in the way they thought, the way they explained the future. And it's there in the way Jesus explained himself to them. So, as we said, there's been a line of critical thought which expresses the idea that the New Testament was written quite late, because there's so much of Greek thought and Greek imagery in it. And yet, when you look at it, that same Greek thought and imagery is here in Jewish writing from the period. And the ideas which they talked about, the points of discussion, the things they fought over, are also here. The New Testament, in its expressions, in its ideas, in its arguments, comes out of contemporary Jewish writing from the time when Jesus was upon this earth.